Welcome to Talk On to Walk On with Michelle Walters, the podcast that celebrates the power of conversation. In each episode, my inspirational guests will share their own stories, recalling times when conversations have led to pivotal moments in their life journey. You will hear about how those conversations and moments of positive self-talk have encouraged and empowered them to walk on to where they are now. The aim of Talk On to Walk On is to inspire us to use words with each other and with ourselves that will change lives. Let's talk on to walk on and see where it leads. This episode is kindly sponsored by Baltic Bespoke, creators of custom designed garden rooms and luxury outdoor living spaces. From office spaces to cinema rooms, garden gyms, bars and cozy dens, Baltic Bespoke's modern, fully insulated garden buildings are tailor-made to your requirements. I absolutely love the garden room that they created for me, which doubles up as my studio. A beautiful separate space away from, but part of our home. Check out balticbespoke.co.uk and their fantastic Instagram site. Conversations combined with sheer determination and grit ensured that my guest never gave up on his dream of becoming an accomplished writer. Although he always had a love of writing from an early age, it wasn't until his 40s that his dream became a reality. Playwright, director and producer Dave Kirby grew up during some of Liverpool's toughest decades. This interview reveals many heartfelt recollections of those whose words inspired him, including his English teacher and later on conversational moments with Liverpool writing legends such as Willie Russell, Alan Bleasdale and Jimmy McGovern. Over 500,000 people have belly laughed throughout his sellout hit comedy plays, including Brick Up the Mersey Tunnels, Council Depot Blues and Lost Soul, all of which draw on the many colourful characters Dave has met on his life journey. Dave also pens stories, poetry and music lyrics that all have the amazing ability to hit you right in the heart. A lifelong Liverpool Football Club fan, Dave has also written terrace verse poetry for the Hillsborough Justice Campaign, and in 2017 he was commissioned to create and consult on Anfield's interactive stadium tour celebrating the club's 129-year history. As well as writing numerous short films, documentaries and a BBC drama, he's also co-written a best-selling book, Here We Go Gathering Cups in May. He also has the absolute honour of being related to me. Dave is a brilliant storyteller, so settle in and listen to how the power of conversation got him to where he is today. Got a quote here that you said you left school with nothing but a PhD in street wisdom, which I thought was brilliant. So as a lad growing up in a working class family in Liverpool, obviously the 70s, 80s, take us back to that sort of reality of life for you then as a kid from Kirby who loved to write. When did that start? Do you remember?
I remember the very first. I used to love reading poems and books when I was a little. I was only like.
So were they in the house, the books and poems, yeah, or was this in school? Yeah, okay.
There was nothing like that in the house, so no. I was just reading in school. I was obsessed with reading, you know, as a kid. And I'm talking like I went in the primary school now. I remember, like, I used to sit mesmerized by some of the poetry. Yeah, but actually writing stuff, that's when I was in St. I've got moved to St. Kevin's now. I'll paint a picture of Kirby at that time. It's all in the early 1970s. And I mean, there was gangs on every corner. Kirby was absolutely gang orientated. It was crazy. There must have been, I mean, there was like five or six kids in every household, you know what I mean? And that was a small family. I mean, one of my mates down the corner was a family of 14, so there was thousands of kids. So anyway, I think there was four schools at the time in Kirby. And St. Kevin's was the boys' school, 2,000 Catholic boys. It's the most populated boys' school in Europe, and it was brutal. It was totally brutal. So when I went there, it was an eye-opener because I went to a little primary school called St. Patrick's, which was all right. It was only a small school, and that was an overspill as well. So the move to St. Kevin's was a massive one for me, but it was like the first year in St. Kevin's, so I'd have been about 11. And I started writing, I used to write little stories and stuff. We got this teacher in English, and East Oakland, there was an old TV detective called Jason King. He had like curly hair and muzzy and all that.
Oh, yeah.
And we used to call him Jason King because he used a bingo for him. Anyway, I was a little bit of a scally back then. I was like, oh, there. I was always messing around at the back and all that. But this day, he asked us to write a poem. But this guy, you know, he was passionate and he started doing poetry. I remember he'd done one by Robert Service, like The Cremation of Sam McGee, it was called. It's like a story. This Robert Service was a great poet. He was like at the turn of the last century. He'd done lots of stuff about the Yukon and the gold digging stuff and that. So he wrote this piece called Sam McGee. But this Mr. O'Brien, with his big muzzy and his big curly hair, he used to come in and off the tables like that. There was strange things done in the midnight sun by men who muddle for gold.
Oh,
and
he was like performing. Oh my God, yeah. So you were gripped. Was it mainly you that was gripped, or was it like everyone?
I think it was mainly me.
Yeah.
Because the
kids laughing at him, maybe?
Yeah,
or?
Because this story you did about Sam McGee, it's about these two guys going on a Klondike. He ends up cremating them because he freezes in the cold. But it was like fascinating me, this piece. But this Mr. O'Brien used to perform it, like going out, and he's doing all that. I think he was like a, you know, wannabe actor, this fella.
Yeah.
And now and again, he'd bring his guitar in, Mr. O'Brien, and sing. So I gravitated to him because he was doing stuff that I liked, you know what I mean? And all the other lessons I couldn't be bothered with. But anyway, this time he said, I'd like you to do a poem about the human body. And it was for the competition. So anyway, I wrote this piece at the back. And we all answered him in. So anyway, next day he went, come here, and he pulled me to one side. He said, this you? I said, yeah, it was me. I said, you think it was? So he goes,
How old were you then?
Yeah, 11.
11, okay.
He said, this is excellent. He said, so he made me feel great.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, go and do me a poem about doing PE.
Was he testing you?
Yeah.
He didn't believe you.
So I said, okay, yeah. So I goes to the back of the class and done this poem about doing PE. And when I come back, he read it and he went, my God, it is you. Honest to God, he made me feel like...
Oh, amazing.
He did it and he said, that's beautiful, son. And he took me sort of under his wing. So then the next year, I had him again in the second year. And I was made, and he was made, oh, David, you're in my class again and all that. So he used to give me little missions since he was doing it. Yeah, I'd say he'd write a poem, but at least to get me to write poems. And by the second year in St. Kevin's, I was starting to get drawn towards all the sort of darker arts of the school, because it was like bunking, smoking, sagging school. We were even all went on strike. And, you know, I was just following the pack. But he said to me this, Sam, he said, so this piece anyway, he said to me, listen, you've got away with words, son. He said, believe me, you've got away with words. And that stuck in my head, you know, and I always remembered it right through. Anyway, I'll speak about that again later on, but what he said to me about a way with words. But that particular piece, when he put it forward to Liverpool Echo and it got published, the one about the body, the human body. But what I didn't realise was that, like, twice a week they'd have a school assembly, 1,000 lads on a Tuesday and 1,000 lads on a Thursday. So I remember being in the school assembly and the headmaster, he had the mortarboard and all that, this Mr. Moorhead. And he was going on about blah, blah, blah. And then he goes, and congratulations to David Kirby. But this poem published in
it. Oh, okay. I know what's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was sliding down my seat because I knew. I thought, oh, no.
Oh, bless you.
Honestly, God. So anyway, as I said, I got booted, punched. I'd all spit on the back of my blazer and all that. So I had two fights that week as well. I mean, the first time we used to get the corporal punishment, then we used to get the strap. That was the first time I got the strap because I was fighting this lad because he was calling me all sorts about, you know, about being a poet and all homophobic stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I was then.
I can imagine.
And my own brother, my eldest brother, he sort of stopped writing poems, you know what I mean?
So oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because it reflected on him sort of as well. That must have just made you withdraw, I'm guessing. Did it make you stop writing for a while, or did you keep turning up to class?
Yeah, I used to do that. I used to punk out and come back in for English, then punk out again.
Right, okay.
I hated maths and all that. But,
yeah.
It was frustrating because I wanted to write stuff, but then what I found I could do, I was knocking around with a gang in Kirby's, about 20, 30 of you standing on this corner. So I started taking a mickey at him. And back then, we all had like the old Fleming's jeans and their wear boots. And,
yeah, yeah.
Or the Dr. Martens.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we were all heavy on them. So I used to stand on the wall and I'd write poems about the lads and stand on the wall and recite them and they'd all be laughing. So I found
it. Oh, okay, through humour.
Yeah, I found it. You'd accept their sort of poverty as long as it, you know, was funny
yeah.
or humorous. So I started doing that in St. Kevin's. And in them days, there was no photocopies or nothing. So like, I remember writing this one about the headmaster. Believe it or not, the school St. Kevin's had a real monkey in the biology lab and it was in a cage for years.
Oh.
Yeah, Jacko, its name was. Jacko. I used to love your pen and everything. It was like a little green monkey. It was there for years.
So, it's mad.
Yeah, so I wrote a poem about the headmaster and the school monkey in an intimate position. The next thing you're trying to find out who's done it. Because like, there was hundreds of it going down the school, but like written in pen copies, right, okay. There's no photocopy machine.
No.
So this poem was going everywhere and I'm trying to find out who it wasn't with me. So that shot me to start on that one.
Okay.
But all the art cases in it, because it was trouble all the time and St. Kevin's no fighting and that. But all the art cases, yeah, Dave writes a poem.
Oh, you were cool now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I had handled myself up, but like there was harder lads than me there.
Yeah.
But I ended up knowing them all, yeah, Dave. So like, yeah, do you want a ciggy, Dave, and all that?
Yeah.
So it was cool to write then.
Yeah.
It was on my terms, it was like, but I realised, you know, it was the comedic kind of humorous stuff that was acceptable, really.
Yeah.
So I carried on, you know, I left school at 15 and basically I was mad into the building trade. Well, I'd been in the building trade with my dad from when I was 13 because I was always in trouble as a kid. You know, I told you I went off the rails.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was 13, something like 12, 13. So my dad used to take me everywhere and mix and plaster because to get me out of trouble. He took me to Wales and everything once. And I ended up in a lot of trouble as a kid. And Kirby, I'll just paint a picture of the Edmonton Police in Kirby in 1974 to stop the gang fighting. But I couldn't walk to the local shop without having a fight. Honestly, lad, there was gangs on every corner. I'm talking hundreds of them as well. You know, remember the one night? It was like the football match. It was sort of like transferring the terraces of the football match where there was lots of trouble then onto the streets of Kirby. Every pub had a gang. And all you did of a night, running battles and all.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Crazy times.
It's more vicious now with knives and that, but the sheer volume and numbers, that's what I grew up with.
Yeah.
So we got all into a lot of trouble when I was a kid. Yeah, to that.
Yeah. Did you ever track down your teacher, Mr. O'Brien?
It's really interesting because once Brickup happens and I started getting out there, you know, I'll go on about Brickup in a minute, but once I got out there, Sean Styles, who's on Radio Merseyside, he's a great mate of mine. He went to St. Kevin's, Sean, as well. So we knew Mr. O'Brien. So I was doing an interview on Radio Merseyside and I mentioned about Mr. O'Brien. I was telling him the story about, you know, when he said, you know, you've got away with words. So I kept on hearing that. Even when I was getting all these rejections over the years, you've got away with words, some believe me. So anyway, we put an SOS out on Radio Merseyside for Mr. O'Brien and we couldn't find him. Anyway, nothing came back. It was about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call to my landline at the time, 2006 this. And it was another teacher from St. Kevin's who Sean had been really trying, you know, for everything. And he said, I've got a number for Eric O'Brien.
Oh, my God, brilliant.
Eric O'Brien, his name is. And
did you know his name was Eric?
No.
Yeah, his name was Mr. O'Brien,
So anyway, we got a phoneless number. I was more nervous.
Yeah.
You know, it was like when I met the footballers for the first time. I didn't know what to do. I said, oh,
tripping over your words,
hello, Mr. O'Brien. I'm still calling him Mr. No, really. And honestly, God, I said, Dave Kirby.
Did he remember it immediately? Yeah, that he did.
So I told him all about myself and what's happening and that they're all caught in the theatre. And he was absolutely thrilled. So anyway, I said, would you like to come up with your wife to see the show? So anyway, it was the last second run of Brickup, 2007. So he came up, he was living down south, and he came up with his wife, and it was like a scene from Gone with the Wind, you know?
Running towards each other.
But the muzzy had gone.
Gone, yeah.
Yeah, and he was like grey hair, but his eyes, he had these like piercing of the eyes, his eyes were still the same. And,
yeah.
And he was emotional.
I bet he was.
Because he said to me, he said, you know what? He said, all your career, all you want to know is like you've connected with one kid. He said, and you're the, you know, the living proof of that. He said, I'm watching this stage and all this. And I'm so, and I kept on him, and I said, you said to me,
you did.
Yeah, he kept on saying, you've got away with words, son. You've got away with words. And I said, that's never left me. I said, so you, I said, this is no down to you. And he said, it was really emotional, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was lovely, lovely moment. And
that is,
yeah,
that's,
so Mr. O'Brien, you know, and I remember there was a girl called Jill Thompson, and Jill was like head of all the English departments across the world in Cheshire. And she was having a seminar in Chester one time, and she asked me whether to come down and speak to all these English teachers across the, basically from every sort of walk of life, even grammar schools and private schools, about connecting. So, I mean, and I actually gave a speech at this.
So massive ripple effect of Mr. O'Brien.
That was the theme that I used, Mr. O'Brien. Be a Mr. O'Brien.
Yeah.
And one of the songs in one of my plays was called Working Class Blues. And that's what I recited to them that night, because they wrote the lyrics, and basically, you know, it explains that you are, and you just get pushed into the system, don't you, if you don't get a good education. But that's, I remember them all, so they were all delighted, and I got a standing ovation. I was like, so for Mr. O'Brien again, he said,
the teachers are applauding me now.
So, like, it's amazing what an effect he had on my life.
And, yeah.
And I didn't know I was going to end up writing full time. Yeah. But Willie Russell said to me many years ago, he said, you don't choose to write, writing chooses you. He said, if it's in you, it's in you. And that was in me.
Yeah. So how did you meet? Did you come, obviously, Willie Russell, Alan Bleasdale, you know, in terms of the theatre scene was obviously massive then. Were you able to ever go to the theatre? Did you, is that what you did? And how did you meet them? And did you walk up to them and ask for advice? How did you get on their radar?
Okay, well, I told you about St. Kevin's, as I say, it was a brutal school and all that, but there's some fantastic lads that I met. And one of them was in my year, and his name is Andrew Schofield.
Okay.
The actor.
There we go. The start of a beautiful friendship.
So, like me and Zoo, we were good mates, we just connected because he
like
was
Lennon and McCartney, innit?
It is, yeah. Yeah, not that. But yeah, he was great. So we sort of gravitated to each other because, like, he was dead funny too as well.
Yeah.
Skilled, you know, he was hilarious. And I was always messing around. So we met then. And then, so years later, we just kept in touch. And every time he was in a play, that was the very first time I went to the Everyman because of him. It's only because of Andrew. I don't think I'd have gone, but there's a play on called Love and Kisses from Kirby. It was about the ski slope that they built years ago, which was facing the motorway.
So, that's hysterical.
Anyway, it was all corrupt. Councillors and everything Kirby was doing. It was a great play, actually, by Tom McGrath. And that was the very first time I went to the theatre. I thought, this is good. I like this. And because Drew was in it, I was made up.
So, watching him.
Yeah, but I was in the building theatre at that time. I was like doing my thing, and then I go and see Blood Brothers when the inception. I remember when Blood Brothers
schools, didn't it? Didn't there four of them? I remember watching it in schools, and it was the very first musical that I ever went to see.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So Drew was in that, so I used to go and see him and stuff. I remember going down to Nottingham, and he was in Willie's play, John Paul George and Ringo and Bert in Nottingham. That's the first time I met Willie. That's how I met Russell, but they just knew me as Drew's mate.
Yeah.
And Bleasdale, I met Alan a few times years ago when Drew was doing the Scully stuff on the telly, and so I met Alan around then. But it was, as I say, they just knew me as Andrew's mate. So fast forward to when I started writing, even when you start off, you know, you think you're just going to write some sort of magnum opus, but it's not going to happen. Do you know what I mean? It's like the building said, they can't just put it out into a ceiling.
No,
there's a learning process, and you too get better.
It's a craft, isn't it? Yeah,
exactly.
It's a
craft,
yeah.
So from 1999, I started. So by 2006, when Brick Up the Mersey Tunnels got up there, that's 7 years. But in them 7 years, I got mentored mainly by Alan Bleasdale. So I'd write scripts, and I'd send them. And they come back it was like Mr. O'Brien had been in and checked all ticks, and I've still got them in ours, And he's he put laughing out loud and little ticks and
feedback,
advice. So especially for Lost Soul, the first Lost Soul, and Council Depot Blues, he gave me a few great tips on them.
Yeah.
And
and did you always agree with everything he said? Would you get it immediately, or did you ever disagree? Did you ever go, did you dare to question him?
That's kind of amazing.
You know.
But it turned out to be great advice. But I mean, a couple of them are left in, you know, because I'm not too sure what one time is that. Sorry, Alan. So
yeah.
I used to get a laugh at the Royal Court because the Royal Court was totally different than the Everyman.
Yeah.
Because Willie was telling me like years ago they couldn't even use any expletives in the Everyman.
Yeah.
Sorry, in the playoffs. He could in the Everyman a bit more, but the playoffs, no. It was a no-go. So with the Royal Court, it's a populist, you know, totally populist theatre. So I mean, Alan was reading and going, what are you going to get away with this?
He actually
came to the dress of the years and I've picked up the first one. And he said, you've got it, it's on your hands here. He said, you've got it. I'm telling you now, he said, this is going to be a hit. And he said, he called it.
Yeah.
So so he's been a great mentor. And I got to know Jimmy. I actually done it.
Jimmy McGovern.
And I wrote a monologue once. And it was like a monologue competition and I won that. And Jimmy was the judge. And that's when I first met Jimmy. That was about 2004. You know, that was a call of the builder's strike and all that. Jimmy's into all that, you know, socialism and that. Yeah. Because I was on strikes and everything right through my career in the building stage.
Did you used to write things down when things were happening to you, or is this just getting your experience just get ingrained in your memory? And where does the passion come from for what you're going to write next? Like, why that piece?
Well, at first, I mean, it just when you're creative, I mean, a lot of the stuff I've written. It's from characters I've met that many.
Yeah.
And like the theme, I mean, so Alan Bleasdale said to me one time, he said, it's the theme of a play that will work. So like The Last Soul, as you mentioned before, is sort of middle-aged angst and that kind of stuff. And I was sort of going through it at the time.
Yeah.
The Council Depot Blues was obviously, I mean, the main actor in it, Andrew Schofield. That's basically me, my journey. That's about despair.
Yeah.
So there was things I really wanted to get off my chest.
Yeah.
And when you first come out.
Because you'd suppressed it all, probably.
Yeah.
Because you were used to just not opening up, I suppose. And exactly. You said this was your way of doing it.
Exactly. So, it's like when a band first burst on the scene, you have a couple of great albums because they're like, you just got loads of things to say.
Yeah.
So, I've had like 7 hit shows now, which is, I'm proud of that. But,
amazing. But
you know, it keeps, the memories keep coming and comedy wise, you know what? I just go into a room on my own, into this bubble, into this little surreal world with all these imaginary characters. And so the creative process is difficult to explain because you can't. Remember Andrew Schofield saying...
It's instinctive, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's in your belly.
You can't teach it.
Mm.
I mean, I went to the workshops in John Moores and they were helpful and I met some like-minded people, which was nice. But, you know, they didn't actually teach me anything to create. Mm. I mean, there was actually a book that they had one time in this workshop that said... Creating characters for script. I was like, you know, breaking down how you create a character, said need that.
No.
I mean, I just based them on people I've met.
Yeah.
Not and all. Especially the Council Depot Blues. I mean, that was...
I've said after that, I reckon that's my favourite, you know.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah.
Is it Stan? Stan, who was the main character?
Oh, Stan, and he's...
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's retiring on the day. And
yeah.
And that was from real life, because, I mean, around all that comedy that's in it, there's like a poignant journey of the old man.
Yeah, and that's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
I love that because you do get the belly laughs and that razor sharp, those quick-witted moments which are brilliant and they're relatable. And, it takes you to a different place, but you bring people back to the realities of life, Dave, and that's what's so brilliant about your writing.
Well, that particular, I mean, and the main character Andrew Schofield plays, Danny, you know, he's got this talent and he's always, because every time when I was in the Council. I was in there for 16 years and it was great and all that, but every day or every week you'd say, I can't wait to get out of this place. Everyone hated it.
Yeah.
Couldn't, I mean, because it was just, let's face it, clearing out shitty empty houses.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? I was one to do that. So the way you got through it was to banter them, bravado and laughing and taking the mickey out of each other. It was only the lads that kept you going. It's only the people that you work with in a dead-end job that can keep you going, and that's what that was about, basically. So that right throughout that play, and they're all trying to get out the council, as you know. That's I used that as the main, the despair of that. And that's where the working class blues song came in. I mean, I remember writing that in the house on a guitar that I found in an empty house in Dingle when we were cleaning
the house. Oh my God, the irony of that.
I know, and I can't really play guitar. I can just strum it, so I just done this, basically, you know, blues tune.
So you can't play yet, you do all these... You do all the lyrics and the poetry around it.
I can play like basic tunes. I don't know what I'm doing.
So do you hear the tune in your head as well?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, okay.
But then I give it to the musical director, who was Howard Gray on that. And Howard just takes it to another level. He brings, you know, Duran the banjo, keyboards and everything into it, you know what I mean? But the actual lyrics to that, you know, it sort of described basically that whole kind of theme of that play, which is like, you know, the song was Working Class Blues. Way back when I was a schoolboy, nobody told me to score. Most of my teachers were useless. My education was poor. So I left school with nothing. Most of my friends did the same. They stuck us into a system. Now we're just playing the game. Now I'm counting down the years, wishing I wasn't here, hearing voices in my ear, singing those old working class blues. These days I'm constantly thinking about the life that I missed. That's why I'm constantly chocker. That's why I'm constantly pissed. He stole the dreams that I cherished. He came like thieves in the night. He stole my education. That's why I'm shoveling shite. All around this goddamn country, the song is always the same. We're all just part of the system. We're all just playing the game. Now we all count down the years, down our sorrows and our beers, hearing voices in our ears, singing those old working class blues. So that was the piece
that's
I've done.
Amazing.
I've done that. So they made that into a song, but you can feel in that.
How long did that take you to come up with, though? I mean, that's phenomenal. And it just, like, I can feel the emotion welling up in me, and I've never been in that place.
Well, it was like, because it was coming from the heart.
Yeah.
I've lived it.
Yeah.
I've lived with guys like that. And like, while I was writing Council Dr. Wu, although it's a spoof and it's a laugh and everything. Yeah.
Powerful message.
Yeah, when I was writing Stan's Journey, there was at times I was like, I was well enough, and you know, there was tears. And that's Jimmy McGovern will tell you, you know, if you don't cry or laugh at your stuff, you know what I mean? It's not working. So I knew if I start crying when I'm writing something, and Stan's Journey really, because I was thinking of loads of old guys that I'd met, and you know, when they'd left us, the council, and within a couple of years, they're gone. They'd pass away because they can't handle it. Well, they didn't want to leave, you know what I mean? I remember one particular guy, and he's like, ah. And that's basically, I can't wait to get out of here. And he was counting down the days, and then on the day, he broke his act, man. And he was a tough lad, this. His next box had tattoos and everything. And we used to have a little party for them. You know, that's what the basic premise is in the play, isn't it?
Yeah.
And at the party, he broke down. Harry, his name was, but I won't say his second name, but Harry. And he broke down. So he was a tough lad, so he didn't want to go.
Institutionalized. Yeah. So you were his world. You know, that was his routine, the banter as well, between fellas especially.
Yeah.
It's, absolutely. You know, it would escape, keep them away, even though the actual job was crap, the banter between the fellas was priceless.
Exactly. And right through that show, that's how they keep going, and all, especially in our city. I mean, the banter is like ridicule, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We all rip each other, come to bits.
Thick skin.
Yeah, it's like, and it's like that's
self, you just got to take it.
That's self-deprecation and all that. There's all that going on. But I use like different characters in that, you know, to catch each generation. And the young fella, Shorty, everyone loved him as well. He was like, he's all right there, kid.
With his hands down, his trousers.
Wannabe drug baron. I met a few of them, and a couple of them went on to be drug barons as well. So there was so much everyone in that. But like the basic theme of despair was there, right through it. And Stan's Journey, which was great, fantastically played by Phil Hearn. And, you know, he caught it perfectly. Because if you stripped all that away and just followed his journey, it's quite a sad story. He's thinking back and everything, isn't he? So, and he lives on his own. And like he was based on his character. And as I say, you know, this Harry fella who broke down. And then about 3 months later, he started coming to the council, even when he wasn't living there.
Still coming to say hello. Because he didn't know what else to do.
Just sitting in the canteen with us, just having his dinner and then go home again. He had nothing. Do you know what I mean? So I captured that. It's probably, out of all my plays, you know, it's probably the closest to my heart because there's so much in me in there.
Yeah, that's probably why it's my favourite as well.
Yeah, people ask me about that, you know. I love them all, but I mean, that one in particular, you know, has got a lot of me in there. I was just gutted because my dad, I started writing them when my dad was still alive.
Yeah.
And he passed away in 2007 at Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And it came out in 2008, and I was halfway through. And I used to tell him bits and pieces.
Yeah, he's in it though.
Yeah,
he's there, isn't he?
Well, I used to hang his cap.
Yeah, yeah.
I used to hang it in the canteen.
And didn't you use your bag as well from your building days?
Yeah, yeah. So
your plastering bag was
it? We still have
your tool bag.
Yeah, yeah. From all over. So it was a nice story, that book. But Cancel Depot Blues, yeah, that was it was a nice piece, but obviously captures everything that I was trying to, you know, that I was trying to say, especially at that time. And I didn't know what to do with the council, because it was that, I worked with bricklayers, plasterers, ends up on the rubbish wagons, and so it was that fast. I thought, how would you put that into one show? I just thought of the six most craziest, wackiest characters that I met.
Did they recognise themselves? Any of them been in? And
all the council lads who come in, like, Dave, that's got to be so and so.
Yeah, yeah.
The big fat slob who's plays the foreman.
Yeah, yeah.
He's real. I wouldn't say his name, but everyone knows him, like, he was a slob. And there was no respect for, like, all the bosses there.
Yeah.
Came across and that, you know, he'd say, come on.
Because they demean you, wouldn't they, yeah. I suppose? There was thought they were better than you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the bosses were, like, ex-tradesmen who couldn't do the job, and they just get put in an office somewhere, take it away. And the sign is telling you, come on, let's have
shit.
You know what I mean? So yeah. There was no respect there, I mean, but it was a great 16 years, and I met every type of character that my city could produce. Lucky enough, I've had some great actors in my piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Funny enough, Bobby Schofield, who's the recent piece by Jimmy McGovern, Time.
Yeah.
You know, the three lads are now, Sean Mason, James Nelson Joyce, and Bobby Schofield.
All being in yours.
Yeah, all being in my work. So it's nice to see them coming on.
Yeah, yeah.
They're a new breed of good actors, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you've given them the platform and the place to practice and art. And
absolutely.
Yeah. Especially live theatre is like the best place to do it, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of really nailing the character and being live in front of an audience that are expecting, certainly from your writing, the belly laugh, but the empathy and the poignancy and the, so they've got to get it bang on, haven't they?
They've got to get it, yeah. They've got to get spot on. I mean, and Andrew's top drawer.
Yeah.
You know, top drawer.
But obviously it's not always been, obviously you've had tremendous success, but, you know, you've also had to deal with a lot of rejection, which is, I guess, is probably normal and synonymous with the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But again, I think you've had your fair whack, haven't you?
Yeah.
Tell us about that and how, again, what you did to just keep going, because obviously if the money's not coming in, you've got a family, all that, you know, what was it, again, other than those words of Mr. O'Brien, which I know have never left you, what kept you going to pursue your dream?
Well, it was like, you're talking about 7 years at the rejects. At first, I mean, the scripts I used to send to the BBC and stuff, they came back, they used to always come back and the same brown envelope, and so you knew what they were.
Yeah.
But like, looking back at some of them, they were a bit futile, to be honest.
You for sending them in though, you know?
Yeah, but you think you've just written something great. And as I said, it was early days there. So by the time you saw them in 2003, which is like 3 or 4 years later, me and Nicky also just basically said about Nicky. Nicky's from Kirby, like myself, he went to St. Kebs and all that. Great football fan. We used to go, you know, meet at away games and everything. So he's a great lad, Nicky. So, and he used to meet at football and just talk about the arts, you know, like my writing, you know, and it was what football conversation get put to one side. And we just go on about writing for ages. So he had the same kind of mindset as me. So we got together around 2001, 2002, around there. So we came up, we were in the Casa one, at the Casa Bar. Oak Street, which is great, all the sacked up as a set that up. So we're in there, and big John Cowley, cracking fella, ex-soccer, God rest his soul, passed away now, John. But he was dead funny, this John. And he used to do quiz nights every week. So me and Nicky used to do this workshop in the uni and go to Casa for a bevy after it.
Yeah.
And anyway, John was going, and anyway, he was reading the Echo this night, man. Seeing this cheeky Cowley set, and there was a letter in the Echo, the letters page. Some woman from the Will, written in and criticising the Liverpool accent, because some girl who works in her canteen in the Live Buildings where she worked, she said it doesn't portray the capital culture in the correct light. Right, she's a bit too rough and ready. Honestly,
wow.
So we're believing this. This woman's from Heswell.
Okay, all right. Okay.
And she works over here, slagging her. She's coming over here and slagging her accent. So anyway, there's like for half an hour, there's like this anti-world to that. We went on from the snooty element of the world, obviously. But there's also we just come to all these surreal situations. We had like cans of fun shooting the ferries up the mares, you know. We were thinking of all these mad things.
Yeah.
So Big John says, we should write something about it. And Big John said, why don't you go upstairs? And during the week, he said, write something about it. I said, all right, yeah. So me and Nicky, just once a week, we used to go up on Monday. And it was Mad Mondays, remember on town, Mad Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'd be upstairs in this room, like, we just started writing this particular Mersey song, just going through the notes and that. And they were all singing downstairs. Yeah, they're all singing on the Mad Monday crowd. So that's where it started. So the inception of Blick Up the Mersey Tunes came to that. And funny enough, we used to use that particular letter from the Echo in the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like that woman from Eswell, she'll never know what she started. But it was like a class thing. And then we made it like panto-esque.
Yeah.
And but the actual theme of it, you know, was like, we were angry, man. He's cheeky.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
You get that kind of insularity, don't you? You know, anyone having a pop at us, they get it back.
Yeah.
No one from our city.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was all that going on. And when we used to, when the song, Bridge Over, when the Runcorn Bridge blows up, it used to be like someone scoring the...
the cheer in the crowd. And
it was one night.
Make you jump that as well.
But there was one night when it blew up, and it was like, honestly, God, it was like Liverpool scoring in Istanbul. And like, there was even paper planes coming down from the circuit down to the stalls. And then when it all settled down, this little voice went, "How am I going to get home now?" That's fantastic fun with that. But like that came to anger. But that particular play, we offered it to the Everyman and Playhouse in 2003. Rejected it. Wasn't for them. We had it in the Comedy Festival in 2004. It got a skipped an amp performance. Andrew Schofield was in it. Went down a storm, and we invited them. They came along and didn't want to know. So like, they rejected it twice. So where can we go with this? And lucky enough, Kevin Fearon had just got the lease on the Royal Court. So I went down to his office at the time. It was Royal Hard Comedy. He was in the Royal Hard Comedy. And I just walked in and I had the script. Well, we only done half the script. It's just the first act.
Okay.
So I just turned on his table like that. And he looked at me and I said, "You don't know me, mate." He said, "But you're going to produce that." I said, and he's looking at me like that.
So confident.
So he goes, I said, "By the way, Andrew Schofield's going to be in it. I'll see you later. There's my number on the front." But I hadn't got 10 yards on the road, and he came out and said, "Come, can we have a coffee?" So I'm like, that's how I just went in. And all this,
yeah, very confident.
Just fronted him. Because
you believed in it.
I mean,
in terms of the rejection, though, were you just fired up?
Angry.
You were angry, yeah.
Angry, yeah. I mean, I'm angry, I mean, passion. Because I knew the people who were rejecting me, it was like, I was trying to tell them, listen, this will work in our city. You don't know.
Yeah.
You're not from our city. That's not being insular. It's just being a realist.
Yeah.
I said, this will connect. So I was determined. And I remember every time they did reject, the second rejection, I was going berserk. I thought, they haven't got a clue what they're doing, but thankful enough, the Royal Court was happening. But then in the meantime, in 2005, I got working with Kensington Fields Community Centre, which was a lifeline really, because I was a week away, not 4 days away from going back on the trial, Glaston, because of being rejected. And they rejected Lost Soul. As well. So
you were really feeling it then?
Yeah, and I got a radio play rejected, so I was like, that's this rejection. I used to just go to the gym, and I was like, yeah, there's wall bags.
I was going
to
ask you, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, I used to go to the gym and like release, and there's wall bags. Just did the wall bags for about half an hour and go home. They're not going to beat me. I was like, angry.
Where did that come from? Because some people would have just given up.
Yeah, I think it's from the streets I'm from, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I mean, as I said before, I was involved in lots of struggle as a kid. I was even in Bristol for 18 months. You know what I mean? That was like all of gang fighting and stuff like that. So I was always in trouble. But that anger, I think when you're from nothing, you've got an anger in you. You know, I always say to you'd never see a middle-class boxing champion. They're always from nothing.
Yeah.
They're fighting. You know, you'd never see like...
Resilience.
You look at Steven Gerrard from the Bluebell Estate. You look at Wayne Rooney from Croxted. You look at Jamie Carragher from Marsh Lane. They're angry.
Yeah.
They make it. If you got some sort of talent, you've got that anger as well. You're driven.
Yeah.
And when you keep getting rejected, I wasn't having it because I knew in my own heart of hearts that, you know, we had something and we could connect. And Kevin Fearon seeing it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he was commercially driven, which the Everyman Playhouse aren't. they just funded by the Arts Council, so they just put what they want on. They said, we'll tell you what we want. No, we tell you what the city wants. You don't. It's not the other way around. I mean, I'm receptive to Shakespeare and stuff, and yeah, fair enough. I respect diversity, but it was all one way with them. Jim Bottinett and Deborah Aidan, they actually, well, I like to thank them now because they drove me.
Well, that's the whole process, isn't it? That's what I love about the fact that you kept going, because you've got such a brilliant story now of rejection after rejection after rejection, yet it just fired you up even more. It didn't knock you down. It could have easily done, though.
It could have done, yeah. I mean, maybe less of people would have walked away, because I know plenty who have, you know what I mean? That's it, game over. But like, I was driven, I was so passionate at the time. I used to be writing for all hours. I'd only have like 2 or 3 hours sleep at times, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was angry, like, they're not going to beat me. But to tell your wife that you're giving up your job to just pursue this writing thing, and then nothing's happening 16 years later.
Would you voice off to Julie and tell her how you felt, or would you keep it in again?
Well, I'd tell her, to be honest, I didn't tell her.
You're protecting her, really.
I didn't tell her about the rejections. Because she knew about the ones that come through the door, obviously.
Yeah.
I didn't tell her about the Everyman ones, and that's actually got Andy a party. Because I said, for 6 years I've been on one. She started doing extra hours. She was working there.
Incredible.
The Giro Bank, then she's done extra hours to sort of fund my dream sort of thing. But because I was writing of a night, but I was falling asleep. Yeah. After plastering of the day, I'm falling asleep. So you needed the solitude.
You're so dedicated, though.
Yeah. But it was like that, this dream, and I wouldn't give in. But like that anger, and it does come from, from the street you're from. I'm convinced of that.
Did I read that you actually probably saved the Royal Court? Are we allowed
Absolutely.
To say that?
Yeah, no. Well, Kevin Fearon, that is, he's the CEO of there. He'll openly admit that.
Yeah.
Because I give Kevin his due at the time. Yeah, we've had a few ding-dongs, me and Kevin, but obviously,
That's business, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, we get on.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was his last throw of the dice, because Brickup was like, they saved the building. If it wouldn't have worked, the lease wouldn't have been renewed. So it's safe. So everything that's happening at the Royal Court now goes back to Brickup and Maisie Tunnel. So it is a massive part of the history of that.
And the whole ripple effect into the local economy is obviously absolutely massive as well.
Massive,
because they don't just come and they come and eat now there as well. You can eat and drink, and that's what's so lovely about it.
Yeah, it's like a cabaret for
it is.
It's lovely, and the client and people trust it.
The key with you though, Dave, is that you make it real. You make it real, and that's what people come for. And like you say, that escapism. But coming back to the football, talk about escapism. We've had, like, obviously, I don't know how many months without fans now. And it's like, that's been hard, hasn't it? Because obviously, I know more women and families are going to football now, but in particular for men, and getting away from the realities, football, banter over a pint with the mates and getting out. And I was going to say every Saturday, but it's not Saturdays now. It's on all different days. I can never keep up. But historically, it was Saturday, wasn't it? Saturday afternoons with your mates and that whole. You probably wouldn't open up about what was really going on in the heads and in their lives, but it was like the theatre escapism, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
So, in terms of mental health and all that, we need it back, don't we? We need theatres back. We need the footy back. Yeah. We need to be getting back out there because it's more important than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was younger, the thing about football as well, especially from a fella's perspective, we don't really talk or express emotions, and especially my generation, and it is the same for a lot of lads. But I mean, I don't think there's once in my life I ever saw me alpha or my brothers and all that you love them and all that. You don't go there, you know what I mean? But if I'm in the cup and I have Mick and I have Kevin's next to me, Liverpool scored a goal and got my tongue down the throat and everything.
Yeah.
So, there's a bond.
Bond,
thing.
Connection.
That sort of hugging and touching and all that. So football breaks down a lot of barriers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that for me was that was a big one when I was younger, honestly. But to just go and escape, and that's why I love the football club, because it'd be the same for Evertonians as well, you know what I mean? It's not just Liverpool, it's just
football generally.
But the women, everyone talks about women going now, they were going back, and when I went to Rome in 1977, was all the women on the train, all done on the done up in like all costumes and that.
Yeah.
It was great going around, we were on 5 days on the train. Should have seen them coming back.
Yeah, they weren't as immaculate.
So
yeah.
They've always been there, you know what I mean? And it's just.
But women are more sort of, again, just generalising, but they're more open to talk about what's going on in their lives with each other, aren't they? Slagging off their old fella or whatever, you know, the husbands and they talk about their kids and stuff like that. I think they're much more open about, whereas men traditionally just aren't like that. Yeah. Like you say, someone scores a goal and it's that hug and that connection, that banter, having a pint afterwards and before and all that.
It's
massive.
Some of the best memories I've got, you know, in my life, you know, is around football, you know, the travelling.
Yeah.
You know, especially going away out of town. And stuff
creating
like
amazing memories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's lifetime memories and stuff. So, you know, you never forget these things. And that was my only escape when I was in the building today. Now and again, I go to the theatre to see Andrew, but the main one was football for me.
Mm.
You know, and that was, yes. That's been from day one. I mean, I started writing the Liverpool FC poetry stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, it was under an alias at first.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what year was that?
I started doing that about 1999.
And how did that come about?
It came about because I seen a poem. At the time, there was a thing called Red All Over the Land. And it was a fanzine outside the cop that got sold. And they also had the internet was just starting around then, around 1999. And they had like a forum. So I used to go on the forum, I was braces and boots, I didn't say my name. And I was just ridicule everyone all the time, you know, it was just like a piss take thing, you know what I mean? All funny stuff and that.
Yeah.
But then now and again, I throw a poem and they go, who's this fella?
Yeah. But
it's someone about my mate saying, Tommy McFadden, God love him, Tommy. Yeah, he passed away in 1996 and he was only 30 odd. So I'd done a piece called a homemade flag and onto braces and boots. You know, but I didn't put my name to that either. So they got on Radio Merseyside, they actually read it out on Merseyside. It was going around everywhere, going, who's done this? So it was me. But I didn't tell anyone, but I did tell the family. I went and told Tommy's mum. And because it got people from all over the world, like, you know, making comments on it on the forum. So I took all the comments down to Tommy's mum. And she was delighted that I'd now rekindled his memory again. So it was a nice piece, that. So, like, that guy.
So was it about him as a supporter?
No, we call it a homemade flag because what happened, me and Tommy made it. Like these days, you can just go and order a flag and then it comes in a package the next day, all done for you. But
to make them?
Yeah, back in the 70s, it was like an old bed sheet.
Yeah.
That we had. Yeah. A bottle of time. That was funny.
He didn't tell your mum. No. Just make it. Yeah. You're like, wait. Just chewing the bed and it's all gone missing.
That was more or less it, but we took it and we tied it. And we got a bit of some red dye. I should have seen the state of
my hands. Honestly.
But it was pink in the end. So we had to put more anyway. We'd some of the state of the sink, like cleaning it for hours before we married on. But we were only about 14, 15, me and Tommy. So we made this, we spent weeks on it, and then we cut this old tablecloth up and sewn on the letters of Liverpool and all that. So it was ages, you know, needles in your fingers and all that. So it took us weeks, but we put a lot of love in that into that flag. So we took it to the 1974 FA Cup final and we used it to sleep in because we went down on a midnight special and it was just sleeping in Houston and everything with it. And all around that was funny that day. We all ran up to Buckingham Palace singing Wake Up and all that. And trying to wake the Queen up. Someone said, yeah, let's wake the Queen up. About 300 of us running up there.
I bet you did wake her up.
And then Prince Philip, he was singing, we walk a million miles to the end. Oh, no, it's Prince Philip. I'd been at Buckingham Palace singing that. So it was a crazy day, but great memories and all that. So anyway, fast forward, and Tommy passed away, God love him, in the 90s. So anyway, my mum's about a year later, and she was clearing the old the small room out in the small bedroom. She said, there's loads of your football stuff there, can you take it on? So I was looking through this box, it was all scarves and programmes and everything, and then at the bottom, I found this flag. And I'd forgot about it, and I opened it up, and it broke my heart. Because if I'd known it was there, I'd have took it to the funeral, you know? I said that in the little poem. So anyway, it was about this homemade flag. So I had Tommy's memory. So as I say, in the end, on Merseyside, it was everywhere, and then And he found out it was me in the end.
I'm going to have to get you to read it, aren't I?
Do you reckon, yeah?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, I'll do
finish
that
the story.
I'll do that in a sec. Yeah, but yeah. But yeah, so there was that. And then I'd done it. Obviously, there was the Hillsborough stuff. As soon as Hillsborough came, yeah, I'd done a piece. I went to Hillsborough. I was at Hillsborough.
Sorry, yeah. did your name come out after that poem?
After
Radio Merseyside, hunted you down.
I was still on Breeches and Boots.
Okay.
But it's all the family, it was me.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So I was still like an alias. And the reason I was under this alias for a couple of years was because...
I guess what happened to you in your childhood.
Yeah, because I still feel all this ridicule I got for writing and being sincere. And this, obviously, Tommy's poem was sincere. And but I mean, if it's being a funny one, I don't know what it was me. But
it's interesting.
Yeah, so I was like, I could still sort of feel them blows and all the...
Yeah.
So I thought, I'm not. So this place is in Boots alias. So was that like for two or maybe 3 years nearly. Yeah, something like that, because it was about 2002.
And did you want to put your name to it, or you really did? You were just be frightened, really?
Yeah.
About what the outcome would be?
Exactly, yeah. But I knew the family would want to know. Willie and John, the dad, and that, so his brother. So I knew, I told them, so they all knew it was me. But I didn't tell the forum or the magazine or the Red All Over the Land thing. So, but like it was about 2002, and is it Hillsborough? I was going to the Hillsborough. I went to the Hillsborough Memorial thing, Mass, every year. And I was going to that. So I wrote this piece because I was at Hillsborough. I know a couple of lads who didn't come back and stuff. So, but on the way there, on the coach, there was a kid opposite me in the aisle there. And I was talking to him all the way. He was going, John Barnes, he was going, oh, he's a lovely kid. Yeah, I'm his mate. And the year before, 1988, we went down that middle section down that tunnel. And it was horrendous. I mean, because you couldn't get, the way you go into a ground, you can just disperse. It was like, it was completely closed in. So the only way back out was through the tunnel. So we went in there, and we remember spinning that just the year before, 88. So we all end up at the side. So I was telling everyone that, don't come down that middle bit, go to the side. So I was talking to this kid and all that on the coach to Hillsborough in 89. Anyway, long story short, after the game, no Sam, this kid and his mate, and we were the last coach back from Hillsborough. We didn't get back till 11 that night, just looking for this kid. And I got a phone call the next day. He'd gone. He was killed. And I beat myself up for years for not saying something. I'd go up to the left-hand side. So that was it. So I wrote this piece. It was called The Justice Bell. Because I found out, I won't mention the kid's name, but I found out about the family. And like he'd never changed his room from that day. So I wrote this piece called The Justice Bell. And Anne Williams adopted it because obviously Kevin passed away. And she had it. It was great to see Anne with a T-shirt with the poem on the T-shirt. And loads got printed. So I mean, that's when I put my name to
the power of that. Yeah, it's huge.
Because a lot of the other families adopted it for their sons as well. There's quite a few of them who've never changed the bedrooms from that day.
Yeah.
So it was about my experience on that through at Hillsborough. But so that's when I put my name to that one, Dave Kirby. And that was it. I was out there and I come out the closet. But,
it was the right time, wasn't it? And for the right, the right reasons.
Exactly, yeah. So, and then from then on, that's when I started doing the performance poetry for the Hillsborough Justice Campaign because I was part of that.
Yeah.
So my mate, Peter Carney, makes all the flags he made that famous Hillsborough flag and all that, that one,
Peter
Mays, all of them, and he was massive in the HJC, so he got me involved in Benefit Lights, and that's how I started doing performance poetry at the Masked Theatre, Benefit Lights, and so, so after that was like, so that's when Tom Cassidy from Liverpool FC, he heard about me doing these poetry nights, so he goes to me, he phoned me up this day. I didn't know who he was, and I arranged to meet him. And he said, "Listen, I hear you do football poetry." And I said, "Yeah." And he went, "Listen, I'm dead worried." He said, "I'm going to do these nights. This is like after we won in Istanbul." He said, "We're going to start doing these big nights at Anfield, and we wouldn't mind getting you on." He said, "But I'm a bit worried about the word poetry." And I'm getting a pause on that.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh my God.
Here we go again.
Yeah. So,
but you knew.
Yeah.
You knew.
So once I'd done my first.
You were more confident then, weren't you?
Once I got the first one, out the way, I was laughing, and we'd done loads of them in the end. So that's how it started, but I was getting mods on. That was 2005, and I thought it would pick up the Mersey. You know, that came out in 2006. And finally, you know, Kevin Fearon, he agreed to do it, and 2006 in the August. And he said, that was another thing, he said, oh, don't put a play on in August, everything goes to Ahmed. That's in the thespian way. I said, August is the best time to throw it on. I said, no, that's no, it's going to Ahmed. No, I've never heard of it. So like I said,
it's
traditionally go to Ahmed in August. That's the time to open this up then. Because they said, you got no competition to it then.
Yeah.
So anyway, they did, and I'd smashed it. First week, they only had it on for 3 weeks, but you know they couldn't get the actors, because the actors were like, what's their name, contacted actors with other things and other things. So they couldn't extend it because they were smashing it. So in the 2007, when it came out, they had it on for 6 weeks. And it was something crazy. It was in the 6 weeks, there was almost 70,000 people. It went nuts. It went absolutely crazy. So yeah, it just took off then. Yeah. But I was out there by then. But ever since then, I've never looked back, and I sort of like, now and again, I do a poetry thing. I've done something called Footsteps of Our Fathers one time for LFC TV, because LFC TV, you know, they all of a sudden they were interested in me and was always on there for years doing different things. And I've done a piece called Footsteps of Our Father, which I'm proud of, because it was LFC TV. It's only a little 3-minute piece, but LFC TV put visuals to it. And it was before Liverpool played Cardiff in the cup final at Wembley in 2012. But we hadn't been to Wembley since 1996 because Wembley was getting regenerated and rebuilt. So we went to Cardiff, didn't we, for all those years. So we hadn't been back to Wembley from sort of like 16 years. But the last time I was there, I had mates and I had passed away, and obviously my dad had passed away. And so I was thinking about that. So with this Footsteps of Our Fathers, it's on the piece. And anyway, Kenny was watching LFC TV this night and he's seen it. And the lads at LFC TV said, Kenny, he wants a DVD of it. He wants to see it. So he went for himself. I said, oh, that's nice. I just thought he wanted it for himself.
Yeah.
So I'm walking down Wembley Way on the day of the game. I'd just done a piece with LFC TV over on Wembley Way. And then I was walking up Wembley Way to the ground. And my phone goes, and this is Jamie, got it? And he goes, Dave, he said, Kenny's just played your Footsteps piece, he said, to the team. As part of the team talk, he said, this is what it means to the fans. So Kenny played it to the team.
Yeah.
So I got goosebumps. I know. Reminds you after the game, the lad just, because we went to penalties.
Yeah,
no one's played shite. They're like blaming me for it.
Yeah, you were saying not on until we won.
Yeah. So I do dip into the odd poetry now, because of
it's
happened.
For your horses, isn't
it?
It's where it started, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Jimmy McGovern said that to me one time. He said, we all start off as poets. Jimmy used to do political poetry on London Bridge and all that, shouting it at the politicians and all that. So at the end of the day, poetry's in your heart. So I do it now and again, but it's mainly all drama now. So that's where it is at the moment. You know, I've just, my latest venture is a radio play. I've just written a radio play, which I haven't done for years. The last one got rejected, 2000.
Another one?
Yeah.
You'll have to make a list. Pin it on the wall.
Yeah. But since I had the piece on the TV last year, obviously it opens doors for you.
Yeah.
You sort of get more cues.
Is this the Moving On piece?
Moving On episode, yeah.
Yeah.
For Jimmy McGovern,
yeah.
On the BBC last year. So once that was on, you know, obviously, you know, I've written the radio play, so right away, you know, you've had a piece on a TV,
credentials,
get listened to right away. Whereas the last time I wrote the radio play, it was just basically pissing into the wind, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But,
Is it BBC Radio?
Yeah, it'll be Radio 4.
Radio 4, yeah.
Yeah. They're the only ones that sort of do them.
Yeah.
The most credible. There's other channels that do them, but, you know, that's the one you want.
So how does that work then? Obviously, that's a combination of your acting and your poetry, isn't it, I guess? Because you've got to have... Again, cast people to read it out, or how does it work?
They'll cast it.
I think that's a problem with that.
It was not one of them. I mean, it's a powerful piece. It's about two ex-personal inmates, actually.
Okay.
So it's like, it's got to be cast. I just hope to get it right, because, you know, that's, said, I think we're really casting, but I mean, the actual pieces, yeah, it's kind of, because with radio, you know, I'm painting pictures with words as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? As well with drama, I'm just, it's on the stage, it's there. It's been,
yeah.
But with the, that's where the poetic kind of thing comes in. So there's a lot of narrative in it, the narration.
And you've got to really get those images in people's heads, haven't you?
So I'm describing colours and everything, like you would with prose or anything. Yeah. So I'm describing colours and, you know, obviously there's ambience and all that going on. So like, so all that comes into it. So it's like, it's a nice change to do something, you know, with the different mediums and that.
Yeah.
You know, I've sort of crossed over all the mediums now. Because that Here We Go Gathering Cups in May book that we've done, 7 of us done that. And that's the bestseller now. To be deemed a bestseller, you've got to sell 30,000 books. And that was a bestseller within 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. But the club wouldn't stop it.
No.
Because it's too much sort of like swearing and stuff. And it's just about how you got to each file.
You have to ask, who's going to do the next chapter? So hang on. So where does it go up to? Is it Istanbul covered?
No. We done it in 2007 when we got back from Athens.
Okay.
And I done 77. Nicky Oak's on 78. Peter Hooten out the farm, he's on 81. Jexy Dodd, he's on 84. Kevin Sampson, the writer, he's on 85 because we didn't want to leave Heisel out.
Yeah.
I like called John Maguire. He was funny, John, because he'd never really written before, but John's a good writer, but he used to see him on the forums. But we wanted a kid who'd never been to any of the others.
Mm.
And so Istanbul was his first experience.
Okay.
So he's done there.
I bet you must have inspired him. I bet you're wondering if you've... I was going to ask you about that. There's probably loads of writers that you've inspired and come on and...
Yeah. I mean, that's another nice part of the job, to inspire others.
Yeah.
I wrote a school play one time, the Allsop school.
Okay.
With Liam Moore. Liam Moore's a great... He's a great character, Liam. He's a man of God now, but, you know, he wasn't always that way, but he'd say that way. But he's funny because he's still got his, he's from North Korean, he's like, bless your loads, lads. He's one of them. He's great. He's super. That's his favourite saying. Bless your loads, lads. So he's great. So, I mean, Liam, you know, I'd do anything for Liam because, he's a born-again Christian. There's no agendas with him. There's nothing. He just wants to do good for people. So we wrote this piece called Heaven for a Day. And it was like a school piece. And also, and that went down really well as well. You know, we're open to run that round, but I'll come back at some point.
Yeah, I think it's going to be more important than ever.
Because it was gun crime then, but it's more knife crime now, so I can change it.
Yeah.
But that could come around again. But Liam actually won Stars in the Eyes as Phil Collins years ago.
Oh my God.
Yeah, he's a brilliant singer.
Yeah.
But he's funny, as I say, he's still got a scrappy voice, but he's amen, lads, and all that.
So who's going to write Madrid?
That's another one, isn't it? I know, but that's just a nicky. We'll have to update it because we don't. Tony Barrett done Athens, man. Tony Barrett.
Tony,
as I say, but that was 2007. Well, there's been two since then. Kiev as well.
Of course.
Kiev and Madrid. So there's two more to do. So, that was a great. Everyone knows my story, the Rome 77.
Yeah, well, because it was not only the first one, obviously, you got the flag as well. People associate the Joey flag, don't they? Which is incredible. And then, and the fact that you'd never been out of the country before, many of them, and it was like a mass exodus, wasn't it, from the city?
That's it. Well, it was the biggest mass exodus at that time, 1977.
Probably from the country, I'm guessing.
Since the D-Day land.
Okay.
That's official.
I can believe that.
27,000 of us went.
27,000?
That's a wrong.
Oh, well, I was going to say 20, but I was it's only 30.
27,000.
Did you all get in? Yeah. I bet you did, actually. The security was probably less than.
It was a great 5 days, an epic adventure.
Yeah.
Well, that's the meaning. It was 5 days on trains and not trees or drinking.
I mean, that was commitment. But also naivety probably as well, because no one knew what they were going into.
Not at all. I mean, it's only ever been to Talache, so what I mean, that was about it. But it was brilliant, and it was just an adventure. And if I could go, I'd probably do it again, but I'd have to be that age again to do it.
I was going to say, if you were going to take yourself back to, we're drifting into footy now, but if you were going to pick a moment, would it be that?
It'd be that one because, it was the whole.
How old were you then, AC?
17.
17.
You know, I've had some golden moments of the year before. We all, it's like to talk here, you know, me and all the lads. We're on the, I was in the building saying, I thought, I saw this, you know, I was painting and decorating. I got a job painting and decorating. It was no mixing plastic was had.
Mm.
I've been doing this since I was 13, so I said to my dad, I'm getting this paint and circulating job. So I got the paint and circulating job and spewed it to Tochi.
And Benny was made up with you.
Yeah, it was the hottest summer ever, so we all just got off.
Yeah.
And then on a toll down there, and that was, you know, even the adventures there, you know, I bring everything into me.
Characters in your plays.
And the music and everything. You know, I mean, I mentioned a reference there, Tochi, and my last soul too. And, you know, obviously, there's like a little bit of a heartfelt stuff in that as well. I was like just pulling down a little bit. Of, I don't want too deep.
No.
You know, I don't want like 5 minutes.
I bet you could do.
Yeah.
But you probably could, but you're conscious of your audience, aren't you, I think?
Absolutely. And that's another thing Alan Bleasdale said to me years ago. He said, always know your audience.
Yeah.
Always know it. I mean, when I'm writing for Radio 4, like, that's for the nation.
Yeah.
It's a dark piece, you know what I mean? And so people like that. But if I started coming up with, you know, 5 minutes sort of profound soliloquies or monologues and
they'd lose you. Yeah, you'd lose them, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just know what to do in there, you know, but it's nice to have the opportunity it's like your poetry, I can do hilarious stuff and take the mickey.
And
then I can do profound, darker stuff.
What do you prefer?
It depends. I mean, it's funny enough, you get recognised more for your deeper stuff. You know what I mean? Than the comedy stuff, you know what I mean?
But then you hit more people with the comedy, don't you?
I have to laugh when people say, you know, like these people who don't write to entertain and stuff, they look down their nose on it and it's
hard.
It's hard. It's hard. And like,
I can't believe that.
I remember Willie Russell said to me one time, and this is, you can argue with Willie, he said, anyone can write dark. You try and entertain people. He said, the people that can't do it, criticise those who can. And it's a true fact, that.
Yeah.
So all these like...
You've got to be brave as well and have real, like you say, that grit that you've got. I can still see it in your eyes and when you're talking, it's never going to leave you.
No.
You're so determined, but you need that. That's what's kept you going, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Some fella said that to me. He said, how come you're still angry? I said, I don't know. It's just in you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What a great medium for you to let it out. I mean, people let it out in different ways and then their life ends up in completely different places, doesn't it?
Of course.
And whereas you've got, you know, you're grounded, you've got your beautiful family, you've got your lovely home, and you've got, you know, you're in a great place and you're influencing people, Dave, just through the power of your writing, that you chose to do that instead of the other. And how amazing is that? And how inspirational is that?
And I could have went down, you know, different paths, because I've got mates and that who ended up in serious trouble in prisons and that.
Yeah.
And they'd all, as I went down to talk here with.
Yeah.
And we all just like down there, and when we come back, they went down certain roads, and I went down there a little bit with them, but I didn't go all the way.
What kept you back? Your mum and dad?
Yeah, I'd say.
Maybe?
Probably, me and my aunt. No, my aunt, I was in trouble all the time. I was the one who always brought the police to the door when I was a kid. But there was like my aunt for his morals and values. Which I've still got, by the way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then that there was like a work ethic, but also like, you know, there's like the line he didn't cross, you know what I mean? And my mates were I think all of them, I have about 7 or 8 mates, there's only like 1 or 2 that didn't end up in prison.
Wow.
So that's where I was heading with them.
And did your dad, I'm going to say this, Uncle Jimmy ever say anything to you? Because we all loved him and he was such a character, but obviously you would have held him in different... you know, esteem, didn't you, really, in terms of, was he just your dad? Is it since he's gone that you do that more? Or, you know, is it at the time you know that there was a line, like you say, that line not to cross?
Yeah, I mean, he was really strict when he was younger because he was like all his generation. He'd done
the TA and all that as well.
The National Service.
The National Service.
So they were all, like, disciplinarians. So, like, all my generation got that after Taz and that. But like, you know, he was funny as well, my dad. He was always laughing. He was always laughing in our house.
Mm.
But like, there's a line he didn't cross when I brought the busy to the coppers to the door. You know, it was always like,
he was scared of your dad.
But as I got older, you know, I got, obviously he became like my mate then.
Yeah.
I mean? And it's like all kids in it, they're awful, it's just a dad. And then as you get older, you become,
learn to appreciate them. Yeah.
I remember them saying once, I couldn't pay any mortgage and all that. I was really struggling one time. And he said, listen, Sonny, a problem shared is a problem halved. Tell me all about it. And I told him, you know what I mean? And he went, okay, let's sort it out. So, I mean, and that was one of the, like, a nice moment because, like, I never spoke like that to my dad before.
Yeah.
And he helped me out and he had a few quid and all that because I was struggling with my mortgage at the time.
Mm.
I had a house years ago. So, yeah, but I mean, he was great, my dad.
He must have been so proud of you. I know he didn't get to see a lot of the stuff, but you know, even what he saw, I reckon he was probably worried at one point, and then you turned it around for him.
That's the nicest part about it, because I know I was the one that put the grey hairs on my head. I was the one that, especially my mum, and I, you know, they done everything for me. But
she's still going strong now.
She's 93.
Isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Yeah.
When I was in Boston, it was like by Manchester, and they had to get like four buses. It took them all day to get there.
Yeah.
They didn't drive, my mum and dad. Yeah. And he used to spend about 4 hours getting there just for half an hour's visit. Them back.
But if they hadn't come, they knew how important that was to turn up.
Exactly.
To help you and keep you positive and keep you sane and stuff.
You think of them moments and all that sort of thing. Yeah. But my dad, he was great. It was just a shame that he didn't get to see the council double blues. That was the one.
Yeah.
But I'd already got out there with the brick up the Mersey. And I done one in 2005, which sort of got me out there, called What Was It Like in the War? And that was through First Big Productions, Paul Nicholson, great fellow, and Kensington Community Centre. And so I done that for them, and then I done the school panto for them. But then I done Lost Soul on the Unity. Lost Soul started on the Unity Theatre.
Oh, okay.
That's why I invited the Everyman to play. I was nearly rejected it.
Mm.
And then I went to the Royal Court and went nuts. Mm. You know what I mean? It's had four runs now. That.
Mm.
As I say, they actually rejected work just with Brick Up and Lost Soul. There's over 200,000 people seeing them two plays alone.
Mm.
No, I mean, sorry.
That's a lot of people. That's 200,000. You say it like as though it's 2,000, but it's 200,000.
So, I mean,
that's phenomenal.
That's how many people live in 90s. It's the elitist test me. I won't use expletives.
But you kept going and you got it out there, didn't you?
You did it.
How many people talk about it now still?
Uh-huh.
And people see your name and they go, right, I'm going to book that, I'm going to go, I'm going to get my mates together. And again, it all comes back to that communication bond and conversation, the power of it all, doesn't it? And that,
it does,
and that from that, and the fact that you create these characters with this razor sharp wit and humour, that, you know, you get those belly laughs, don't you? And it must be a great feeling to hear the theatre erupt in laughter.
It is. I mean, that's sometimes like, because it takes like 4 or 5 months to knock a play up. People think you knock it up in about a week.
I
mean, funny enough, the TV episode that's on for an hour, it's like on for an hour. They're moving on. I've done that in about 2 months with obviously relights and stuff, but a play. Because, I mean, the camera, I mean, to give you an example, it was like 162 camera moves, like scene changes in the drama on the TV. With the theatre, you're stuck.
Mm.
That's it. You don't go anywhere. So, in Council Depot Blues, there's three scenes. You know, the depot, the house, and then outside the depot, and that's it. And the same with all my plays. You've only got three scenes. So you've got to create a story for 2 hours around three scenes.
Yeah.
It's hard. But when you've got like an open book and just do what you want with the telly, it's a lot easier for screen.
But so, I bet you still prefer the theatre.
It is. It's all, because I mean, when I'm in during that 5 months when I'm in solitude, and you know, and you need the solitude to do it. And the days when you've written something, you go, that's crap, and just throw it away. And the day before, and you look at it and you think it's great on that scene, and you look, so all this is going on.
Mm.
But during them moments, you know, you just remind yourself, and I've got tapes of all the crowd cheering.
Okay, that's interesting.
I just go like that. And put that on.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That's what you're doing it for.
Yeah, making an impact
on
them. Yeah.
Well, it's not about you, it's about them and all that. So to bring joy to people is probably one of the biggest joys of all, to bring joy to others.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
if you were 18, tell us, what would you tell yourself now? Maybe even younger. Let's go younger, 18, I reckon, with you.
18.
16.
Just, I don't know.
Can you picture yourself?
Yeah, I can picture myself. And I can picture myself getting sucked into situations and like following people, and like listening to them instead of just using my own head. I did in the end because I walked away from it.
Mm.
And they all ended up in prison. But at first, I was just like a sheep, or listening. I didn't. So I'd say, just believe in yourself. Don't, you know, question things, and just don't make the right choices, and don't, if you get to a certain point, don't let your education hold you back. Because at first I was like intimidated by academia, I'll be honest with you, by the people I was meeting. Because they all come up with these big words and I didn't understand half of them. No, I didn't. You sort of educate yourself over the years, but I was like very, very intimidated by it. But then once you realise, hang on, these people, no one's better than anyone.
No.
You know what I mean? So don't just believe in yourself, but don't, you know, if you got mates who are going down the wrong road, just don't do it. Well, just think for yourself, because as I say, I could have ended up in a different place. It was that close, you know what I mean? And I see the lads now, you know, they've obviously done time and all that, but
I was going to ask you, have you kept in touch with them?
Yeah, there's two or three who I was in Torquay with. A lot of lads have passed away now, sadly enough, but there's two or three that are left here, but they're out now, and they're obviously they weren't bad, they were just rogues.
It was a sign of the times, wasn't it? There was nothing, there was no aspiration. The city was the whole classic managed decline and all that nonsense of the 80s and stuff. And it was no opportunity, no nothing.
There was nothing. So, obviously, you wouldn't hear no one all the time, breaking into fatties and stuff like that.
I bet you could write a few books on that. As you say, nobody hurt anybody. No, that's the difference to today, isn't it?
When we were coming out to KB Industrial Estate one time, we had a load of cigarettes, and boxes of cigarette wood binds. Never forget it, boxes of wood binds, 6,000 in a box. Honestly, guys. So we were walking over the fields by Simmons Wood Lane, where the Liverpool FC Academy is now. Next thing, a police car burns up, chased us and got us and that. So we had to drop the boxes and that. So the cop was like, "What's in them?"
What's coming.
So he goes like that. Where's he live? So told him where he lived. He booted me off the backside, punched me in the back of the head, said, "Get on." So they put the ciggies in the boot and off. The cop has got off.
Yeah.
He's had a video.
Yeah.
And then
Well,
I mean, there was stuff like that, you know, it was just all scary stuff. There was nothing else then, but they're all made up now. They can't believe it's me doing all this. Which is nice as well.
Yeah. And they must be proud of you, really. Yeah. You know, and plus it's given, obviously they've turned a corner, but, you know, they've been through what they've been through, but they're seeing you and how it could have been for them, maybe. So maybe there's some sadness there, but also some hope as well, like you've, you know, that they see you and they're made up.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, getting to younger kids as well is good.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece called Street.
It's still very much needed, especially now more than ever, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, I've done a piece for Colin McHugh of LA Productions about 10 years ago called Street Heat, and that still gets shown in schools. It's about fire-related disorder, and scary you set fire to bins and all that. But the lads who were in it, they were going to film this at FACTS, so the kids who were in it had all been done for this fire-related disorder.
Mm.
So I had to get these stories out of them. So I'd been to the fire brigade and talked to them. So they would tell me their side. So I had to get the Scallies side of it, how they started the fires and that. So I was doing this workshop with them in LA Productions, and they wouldn't speak to me. So they have the boys, what went on? Not from those greenies.
Yeah, they probably wondered who were you.
Yeah, just like looking at me like that. Yeah. But there was one of them, like the leader, and they were all looking at him, and he was just like that. So I said to the manager, because there was always like a chaperone with them, I said, he was a favourite, give us 5 minutes, he's like, can't. And just, not showing anything. So he goes out. And I roared at them. I said, "Do you think you are?"
Mm.
And I give it to them in their own
voice.
They
probably respected you then.
I said, "Where are you from?" Not a screen. I named a few fellas that know from down there. Do you know where I'm from? I said, "Well, I'm going to walk out of there now." I said, "When I come back, you're going to start talking or I'm walking." So anyway, I've done that. I come back. Next thing, he started opening up, telling us all about how they do it. So I got the script together then. But at the fact when we had the big premiere night, they got tuxedos up and all that, these kids. No, this is all paid for by these private. So they come on a fire engine, about 6-7 of them. They were all like buzzing because we filmed it down Garston and they were all in it. They were in the film. So anyway,
that's a brilliant story.
But this kid who was like the main leader of them.
Yeah.
He comes up to me in the fact, he said, "You're not like all the other fucking mings we meet."
Yeah.
That's what he said.
That's because you were real and relatable though.
Been there. Yeah, so I got through to them. And we made this film, and that still gets shown in schools now. It's like a little 10-minute piece of
book. Yeah.
But it's like hard hitting, you know what I mean? Yeah. Suzanne Collins was in that when I first worked with Suzanne. And that's how I got it into Brick of the Mersey. So it's because I worked with her on that.
Yeah.
So but it was interesting that so I've done little pieces like that, but it's nice to connect with the younger generation. Especially now it needs it badly, don't it? You know what I mean?
So, it does.
So, I'll keep on doing that, and hopefully that heaven for the day, I can start touring around the schools again.
Yeah.
So that'll be a nice one, because I like connecting with kids who've been down that, because I've been down that road.
Yeah.
And I can connect with them in that way, but I just there's no need to go there. You know what I mean? Just believe in yourself and don't listen to, you know, to bad advice or, you know, it's as I say, I regret certain things, but the best thing I ever done was walk away from that. It was hard at the time.
Because it takes bottle, doesn't it? And courage.
Yeah,
because it's easier to follow, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was a follower. I mean, that was one of the big things. And in that Barstool drama that I wrote for radio, one of the characters in that similar to, it's basically me.
Mm.
You know what I mean? He's got a conscience for.
Yeah. You know? Do you feel like when you're doing this writing that it's like cathartic because you're getting it all, like you say, you're getting out your past.
Yeah. Absolutely. I remember Willie Russell saying that as well.
Does it make you feel lighter in a way?
Yeah, because I mean, sometimes you don't realise it's you. I mean, I remember, obviously, once I was writing Council Depot Blues, the main character, Danny, you know, this lad who's got a talent and he's going to get stuck in the council for the rest of his life and he's trying to get out because he knows he's got something, but he's not going to get out. He's trying, but he's not going to get out. But I realised that was me. Do you know what I mean? It was the same in that. You know, the little story I done last year for the number 19 film, you know, when we had Andy Schofield, and it's like a fella thinking back to the homecomings and with his dad and all that, and that main character was me. So, but you don't realise at the time when you're doing it. I remember Willie Russell saying that to me as well, because when he was writing Rita, he said, Rita's basically me. That was him going back to Northern University and all that kind of stuff. So that was Willie. He said, but sometimes it's subconsciously it's you.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is good, but once you see it.
Healing, yeah.
But when I see Council Depot Blues now, I love watching that because I know it's me.
Yeah.
So it is good out of here.
Yeah.
Spot on.
Honestly, it's been absolutely incredible. Is there anything else that we need to cover? Did you want to do a...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd like you to... I'd love you to do that.
The Justice Bounce, to do that.
Yes, please.
The kid on the coach.
Yeah.
This is the one that Anne Williams adopted for Kevin. But it could be applied to any of the young lads who didn't come back that day. And spot the kid who was on the coach next to me. It's called The Justice Bell. It was written in 2002, so I don't know. Anyway, a schoolboy holds a leather ball in a photograph on a bedroom wall. The bed is made, the curtains drawn. The silence greets the break of dawn. The dusk gives way to morning light, revealing shades of red and white, which hang from posters locked in time of the Liverpool team of 89. Upon a pale white quilted sheet, a football kit is folded neat, with a yellow scarf trimmed with red, and some football boots beside the bed. In hope, the room awakes each day to see the boy that used to play. But once again, it wakes alone, because this young boy is not coming home. Outside, the springtime fills the air. The smell of life is everywhere. Violas bloom and tulips grow, while the daffodils dance heel to toe. These should have been such special times for a boy who'd not be in his plan, but spring forever turned to grey in the Yorkshire sun that April day. The clock was locked on 3:06. The sun shone down upon the pitch, lighting up faces etched in pain as death descended on Leppings Lane. Between the bars, an arm is raised amidst the human tidal wave. A body too frail to fight for breath is drowned below a sea of death. His outstretched arm then disappears to signal 15 years of tears as 96 souls of those who fell await the toll of the justice bell. Ever since that awful day, a vision often comes my way. I reach and grab his outstretched arm and pull him up away from harm. I hear his voice, I see his face, but wishful dreams are soon replaced by the vision that haunts me most, an empty seat on a silent coach. On April the 15th every year, when all is calm and skies are clear, beneath the glowing Yorkshire moon, a lone Scotch piper plays a tune. The tune rings out the justice cause that blows due west across the moors. It passes by the internal flame, then engulfs the young boy's picture frame. His room is as it was that day. For 15 years, it stayed that way. Untouched and frozen forever in time since that tragic day in 89. And as the pipes play their haunting sound, tears are heard from miles around, to the tears of the families of those who fell, still awaiting the toll of the justice bell. So that was about the kid on the coach, you know. So that was, that got me out there. Like, but like that was the one that Ann put on the T-shirts and stuff for Kevin.
So I can see it still gets to you when you read it.
Yeah, I mean, because that's me, and I'm thinking of that kid and what I should have, you know.
No.
You know, that disturbed me for years, to be honest. But like as I say, there's loads of different ones I've done over the years. I mean,
is the flag one in there?
The homemade flag?
Yeah.
Should be. That was followed by Mike Myers.
Oh, yeah. He's from Bootle, isn't he? How did you get him to do that?
He just got into me. He gave it a number.
So funny.
He just said, oh, Mike, you get a bet on all that. I went, how'd you know that? Where was your man from? And all that. He just got into me. He was in the so that was a nice touch, that.
That is a nice touch.
Yeah, so like he just took us a forward. It's called a homemade flag. Probably the first one I saw that got me out there, this one. In all the years we've been apart, I thought that time would heal my heart. But the hurt came back just yesterday. It never really goes away. I came back from Cardiff full of joy. I hugged my daughter and little boy. I asked this question again and again. Why weren't you spared to do the same? My mind drifts back into the past. Some 30 years, it's gone so fast. Two teenage boys, all lives ahead, off down to Wembley, draped in red. A homemade flag we took that day. It's incompatible to today. An old bedsheet, a bottle of dye, about 8 foot long and 4 foot high. It took so long to make that thing. Scissors cotton you bring every evening after school, sewn on the letters of Liverpool. Down to London, midnight train. Attempts to sleep were all in vain. Houston is cold at 4 a.m. That flag came in handy once again. Snuggled in our flag like peas in a pod. At 6:45 we were woken by Plod. Wake up now, boys, you can't sleep there. So off on the tube to Trafalgar Square. Only 8 a.m, but what a sight. Trafalgar was bouncing as if it was night. The black and white Geordies, the Liverpool red, as the statue of Nelson looked on overhead. About 300 strong, we then marched from Oak Malice to Admiralty Arch to Buckingham Palace. Let's rake the Queen up, you said, for a joke, when our flag tied around you like Batman's cloak. All day around London, it was much the same team. So proud of our city and the flag of our team. We hungered from buses, we hungered from trains. Then as we hit Wembley, up it went once again. The whole day was perfect and so was our team. The most one-sided final that I've ever seen. I can never forget the joy on your face as we lifted the cup, then we turned and embraced. As the years went by and we grew into men, we'd meet up every now and then. We'd talk of the old times and the things we'd done, like the Exorcist, Jaws, Band on the Run. I remember so vividly the day I found out that God had called your number out. I thought of your parents, I thought of your John, I thought of your wife and your three-year-old son. But death has no mercy, doesn't play by the rules. To take a man in his 30s is so very cruel. You fought it so hard, but always in vain, that a trumpet sounded and the angels came. About 3 years later, I was around at my mum's, looking through all the old photo albums, then my ma shouted up from the bottom of the stairs, "There's a bin bag of yours on the spare room chair." Inside the bag was all sorts of things. Old programmes, scarves and a book called Cop Kings. Tickets, stubs, news clips. Things I hadn't seen for years. Then I stumbled on something that reduced me to tears. I stared for a moment in disbelief. My whole body went weak, overcome with grief. For there, near the bottom of this old memory bag, folded up nice and neat, was our homemade flag. I closed my eyes as I opened it up. My heart was racing as I finally looked. I wept like a child as I kneeled on the floor, as I thought of that day back in 74. I held it tight and whispered your name. Ah, Tommy, I wish I could see you again. If I'd known it was here, I'd have done my best to take it around you and relay you to rest. But lass, now it's mine, and it always will be. When I open it out, it's your face I can see. Adventures and memories that will always last. That flag is my window into the past. So good night, God bless, lad. Until my next prayer, I know that your spirit is around somewhere. You could be millions of miles on some heavenly star. But when I'm holding our flag, you were never that far. Tommy McFadden, 1958 to 1995.
Oh, my God,
I love that. Yeah,
that was like so powerful because I was literally seeing you do everything then. David's just been so absolutely amazing, honestly. I'm really emotional because I know how modest you are and you don't talk about yourself that often, but you've made an exception for me today and I feel very, very proud. I love the fact how you've opened up, especially about the tough times when you were a kid, the kid who loved to write poems. Mm-hmm. You've had so much rejection, but you've walked on through gritted teeth and that will have massively hit home. And I know you'll have inspired, I mean, you've inspired many already, but you'll certainly, I'm very proud that I know that you're going to inspire some of the listeners and the people potentially even watching today, because I've got a feeling I might just stick this out. even though it's a bit rough and ready, it doesn't matter because that's what we are, isn't it? But you've shared your story about what to do when it gets tough, you know?
Yeah.
Dig deep and keep going and walking on. And I want to thank you so much for opening up on about the power of conversation, but especially about the power of the words that we tell ourselves and the power of the words that you write are just incredible. You've got away with words, son. You've got away with words.
Thank you, Mrs. O'Brien.
Anyway, you're a Liverpool legend and you will never walk alone in our great city, Dave. Thank you so much, yeah. Walk on.
Absolute
love you.
Pleasure.
That was so lovely.
Yeah, please stop being sure.
That was brilliant.
The simple yet powerful art of conversation and communication should never be underestimated. And I would love to hear your thoughts and feedback, either via the contact form on my website, talkontowalkon.com, or on my Instagram at michellewalters_. Also, I'd be thrilled if you could help the power of conversation message to reach as many people as possible. To help achieve this dream and so that you never miss an episode of Talk On to Walk On, please rate, review and subscribe, remembering that the simplest act can have the largest impact.